The following presentation was recorded at the 2012 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
All right, good morning, and welcome to this workshop where we're going to discuss for a little while the needs of the very young. And I think you probably find in your communities the same I find in mine, that parents are very concerned about a good start. And that's what we want to discuss here a little bit for a little time. The format is supposed to be something like this, that we have a handout here to work through and lay down some principles, raise a few issues, provide some practical pointers maybe for some skills in preparation for first grade. And then we're to open it up for questions and discussion and anything that you would like to add to this picture. And so you'd be writing down your ideas, questions, whatever you have for the end time here. All right? Before we start, let's just have a word of prayer quickly together. Thank you, Father, for blessing us thus far. Thank you for the way you have provided for all of our needs. And just now, as we consider the topic before us, would you guide us? Our hearts are after the truth that you provide. And help us to find it and to believe it and give us grace to live it. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. We have a few objectives to give us some focus here. And I started with want to look a little bit at the influences that are out there that affect us all in some ways. And maybe they're not so good. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but I do want to lay a little bit of a basis for going in then and laying some biblical principles that we can follow. And the focus is the preschool age, 5, 6 year olds. And so let's start by looking at a few things here. We'll call them humanism and nationalism, and they're big words, and don't let them frighten you or anything. We're not going to be exhaustive here. Neither are we going to be reactive. Just because the premise of humanism and nationalism may be wrong or faulty, does not mean that we just run the opposite direction and everything a humanist says. Sometimes I think maybe we do that. But the thing to understand is that their premise is faulty. And this is important because we want to start correctly. One of the burdens I kind of have for my community is that I know for me as a parent, I want the best for my children. I have 4 children, and I want the best for them. And you want the best for yours. But not only that, I think there's something else that that we think about a lot. There's a natural inclination. We want the best for them, and we want them to get it as painlessly as possible for some reason. And because we're like that, we're just a little bit gullible maybe to some things that are out there. There is a plethora of information on the other side of that Google bar and in the Christian bookstores. And it's all there for our parents to read and find and maybe be influenced by. So I think it's very good for us to give direction to some of these things in our communities. I like that we do that. I think we should do that. All right, let's look at the premise of humanism called progressivism historically. And we believe that children are born sinners, innocent though they be. That's just the way we are. We believe that. May we ever believe that. Humanists, many years ago, it's actually surprising how long history has lasted with this prevalent belief in the world, but it has. And they've decided to get God out of the picture and sin out of the picture. And if you take God and sin out of the picture, well, then children have to be inherently good. And it's their environment that corrupts them. If something is wrong, if something isn't quite right, if they go and shoot their fellow classmates in a cafeteria, why, there's something was wrong with the environment. Okay? And so because they think that way, their emphasis in education is the child who is, if you just take away those awful restraints, he'll blossom and flourish. And who knows the potential that he'll be able to discover? And so we have terms like self-discovery and self-expression. And if I decide to express myself by blowing away some classmates, that's what I do. It's kind of sad. It just hasn't worked out the best, actually, and we know why. Self-discovery is a fine term, but not from a premise that says children are born inherently good. And, you know, that fellow that did the shooting this week, he was expressing himself long before the gun. Did you read that awful poem he wrote? It was just disgusting. And somewhere along the line, they just decided to let him flourish, and he flourished in the wrong way. All right. We can maybe discuss that in more detail later, but let's look at nationalism here a little bit. It has a little bit of a different premise and maybe more of a reactionary premise. Nationalism says, yes, society is fraught with issues, but the way to fix it is through government control. And education must be government control, because the homes are full of deadbeat dads and drunkenness and passiveness. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take all these children out of the home and put them in a place, and over them we'll put this person who is highly trained and has degrees, and he is professional, and he will be able to be a magnet figure for them and influence them. And in the mind of in these people's minds, our nation is the best and our culture is the best, and we will promote it. It needs to be promoted so that other nations don't get ahead of us, you know, and society's ills need solutions. And here you hear a lot about math and science. We must get math and science going. And you have problems like the Head Start. You've heard of Sesame Street, right? Sesame Street isn't exactly the most innocent little thing. That's part of Head Start, and which is an endeavor to get younger and younger children more and more capable and ready for first grade. And their key terms are performance and competition driven. Let's make sure that China and India and South Korea do not get ahead of us. And in our communities, maybe we're a little bit influenced by this. I know we have some parents that have maybe... Well, I think it goes back to the idea of we want the best for our children. We want them to have a good start. And so away we go. And we've asked questions in our community like, you know, we got to get these children ready for first grade. So we need a kindergarten program. Well, how long is it going to be before we have parents saying, well, we need to get these children ready for kindergarten. So we need another program. I don't know. But you see how that thing just continues to work itself down. And nationalism drives that a little bit. That's what secular people are doing. Okay, well, that gives a little bit of a base, some things that are going on in our world and are influencing parents as they begin to think about their young children. And these are things we want to be careful about. And so then how should good Anabaptist Christians think about these kind of things? You know, we said the wonderful gifted child is the center for progressives. John Dewey, I think he said something like, the child becomes the sun, you know, the center of the universe. He was a major progressive. Nationalism, it's more the curriculum or the knowledge and the degrees. What is it for us? What's the center for us? Is it the teacher? Is the teacher the center? I like to think about it a little bit for in my school, in my community, that we have kind of this strong triangle shape of three almost equal entities working together. Truth, the teacher, and the child. And there's this truth that we are after. The child's not going to find it without a master, a parent, or some person leading him there. So the three, I think, work have their place. Maybe that's what we center on, focus on. Okay. Let's look at some biblical principles. I just have a few references that are well known for us to look at here on your handout. And from Deuteronomy and from Ephesians. And there are many others. This will just get us started. We'll talk about four. Maybe you can think of a fifth and a sixth and a seventh. Maybe you can bring them up later. For starters, this passage in Deuteronomy, it begins, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart." And so the first principle I have here that all parents and all teachers should understand, the teacher will teach the contents of his heart. The teacher will teach the contents of his heart. And we understand that. Even if you're a passive parent, somehow that gets communicated. Or a passive teacher. Children are like huge vacuum cleaners and it's on high and they're just sucking it all in. And so you teach the contents of your heart. And I think it's Howard Hendricks that has some kind of a quote that goes like this: teaching that impacts is not head to head, but heart to heart. And that's where that's what really gets communicated. What's in your heart? So that's the first principle. Second principle then is, and I believe I messed up on my counting, but I think you might have it right on your handout. Principle two, the amount of influence is directly proportional to the amount of time invested. And those two principles, I think, lay a foundation. If you have God in your heart and time for your children, you are miles ahead of, you might get a few practical things wrong, but you have a lot going for you. And so the more time you can invest, and my wife gets far more credit here than me, I spend too much time with other people's children. That's the way it works. But time with our children, that's what she's busy doing today, pays off. We want to influence our children, and so time. All right, so those two are very foundational. And we see that here all throughout this verse in Deuteronomy 6. They're going to travel together. And they're going to spend time before they go to bed at night together. Maybe you can compare that to devotional time. Or when you get up in the morning, it's all there. Okay, another principle out of this passage is maybe more practical, more with teaching. Hearing and memorizing are God-ordained methods of imparting truth. And you see the dad here is carving it into the walls. And apparently every time they go in and out the door, they see this. And it also says in verse 4 there, "Hear, O Israel." And these are teaching strategies that are kind of out of... the progressive would rather do it another way, because the progressive looks at the child hearing and memorizing and says it's all going in one ear and out the other. It's not sticking. It's after he looks at the bulletin board for the sixth time, it's irrelevant in his mind. He's passed it out. I know I've wondered that 100 times in my classroom. Spend this time decorating and putting up these sayings. Got a verse on the wall for history this year that's supposed to give direction to history. And I don't know, they read it twice and now they look at it every day. But it's not sticking. But then I think about how I used to go to those boring family gatherings and sit in my grandpa's living room, and he had a plaque on the wall. And I would read that every family gathering just because I was bored and there was nothing else exciting. So I'd look at this plaque, and I can still tell you where it was on the wall. I can still tell you the colors. I can still give you the message. And it was irrelevant back then. It was going in and out. You see, hearing and memorizing have long-term effects. It's all about that what we just heard, right? I mean, yes, it might be going in and out of one ear immediately for the child, but we need long-term vision. And it is a God-ordained method, and I hope we don't lose that for our young children. And we have a Bible memory program for our girls. And my oldest, Rochelle, she was just doing James 1 there about some of those big words there. And she was rattling off those big words. And upbraideth. What does my little 7-year-old know about upbraideth not? And it shall be given. I don't know. But she's got it. and we keep doing that. There's a place for explaining it. But memorizing. All right. The last principle then, before we move on, comes out of Ephesians. Children must honor and obey even though they may not understand. And in society today, we see something a little different. There's a real push today to have understanding first, and then you obey. Is that the way it's supposed to be? Maybe if you're 15, you want to start doing that more. But at 5, my little boy the other day, I turned around, and what was he doing? He had these metal, I don't know, like a hanger or something, was poking it in an electrical outlet. So, I say, Javen! And he, horrified, he looks around, sees this horrible look on my face. So what do? Get out my science book and open up, you know, to electricity, and down we go. That's not going to be anything to him. Maybe a demonstration of sparks would have been beneficial. I don't know. But he just needed to know. You know, self-discovery that the progressives talk about can be destructive. There is a better way, and that's learning to obey even though you don't understand. And I guess I kind of have a real passion for that one. I see in our communities there's more, well, they got to understand, you know. No, they don't. They just have to obey. And recently my students were going over the sayings that I say often, and two girls were talking, and one of them was like, well, one thing he always says is, just submit. Just submit. Because sometimes I tell the students, after we've talked and we've hashed this all out, and they still don't, and I finally just say, you know, this just might have to be an area where you just submit and go on. Maybe that's the first step in building conviction. Actually, I think it is. There's been a lot of things in my teenage years anyway where I just had to submit, and now I've got some good conviction on some of those issues. Although I didn't understand it at first. Okay. You can probably add a fifth and a sixth. If you think of one, bring it up later. So how about some practical skills to develop in preparation for grade one? We'll start there anyway, in preparation for grade one. I actually got these from I spend far more time with high school students than kindergarten, although we have a teacher swap day once a year where the teachers all take turns teaching other rooms. And one year the other teachers wanted me to teach kindergarten. So I went and taught kindergarten. And I had one objective for the day, and that was to make it through the day without any of the 12 kindergartners crying. And I achieved my objective. It was amazing. I didn't think I would, but I did. And something every principal should do, teach kindergarten for a day. But I got these points, these seven. I have seven, and you can add to the list, but I'll just bring out seven. They came from a panel of 6 kindergarten teachers who've taught for more than 15 years. And some of them may be progressive or nationalistic minded, I don't know. But and the practical level here, these I think are important things we want to consider. The first one, you might debate whether it's a skill or not. One thing I know, it better be a skill the parents have. An enthusiasm for learning. And if your child is going to have an enthusiasm for learning, what is that going to take to develop an enthusiasm for learning? I appreciate my dad-in-law on a point. In this area, he is a serious science kind of a person. He he lets his property just kind of grow however, and it's almost this natural preserve type of thing. He's got a pond and every kind of tree and bush and flower you can imagine and all kinds of critters. And he recently captured a black snake, put it in a cage, and fed it rats for his grandchildren to see. And wow, this is amazing, you know, and some of you girls are really, this is awful, but my girls found that really fascinating. And they're learning some things here, and we called him Jake. We called the snake Jake, Jake the snake. And so my grandchildren are flourishing in that environment. There's some enthusiasm being built there. Where I can't always get it done, some grandparents can be really helpful. However, you know, we have to be careful that we don't drive this thing too hard, right? You can drive there. I was impressed a couple years ago with a mom, a patron at our school, who her six-year-old son, she said he's just not interested. He just doesn't seem to be interested in school or learning. And so she has the question, how hard is she going to drive him, push him? And she decided to just hold him back. You know, that's not the end of the world, right? I think sometimes we almost get too pushy. And she decided to hold him back. And today he's in sixth grade. And I just pulled up his report card because I was thinking about this. And he's on a roll. And I don't have, his name never comes up in teacher discussions. You know, teacher discussions always center around the troublemakers. And his name never comes up. He's doing well. He's socially adjusted. He is doing well academically. And so there's a balance to seek. We want to spark that through observation, through a natural way instead of a push. They tell me that the country of Denmark has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Now, it's a little country, you know, compared to the United States, it's not quite a fair comparison. And one of the reasons that their literacy rate is so high, another thing they have is that teenagers are readers. They have a high percentage of teenagers who just naturally pick up books and read them. And what they credit that to is that they do not force their children to read until seven, to age seven. Now, take that for whatever it's worth. I don't know if that's there's some kind of advertising agenda behind that or not, but that's supposedly how the country of Denmark works it. Okay, another skill is a broad speaking vocabulary. And that makes sense, of course. So read lots of stories. And when they ask all their questions, give them what it is. If they get to first grade and there's objects that they can't even identify, they don't know them, you know, that's gonna hurt. And so they need read to a lot. That's how they build a vocabulary. And they need their questions answered. They need to talk to. And so you see the time investment really pays off here. We're back to the time investment thing. The ability to listen. This is probably one of the more stressful ones for me. I was a very absent-minded youngster. And so, of course, then it only carries that my children are the same way. And I have one four-year-old girl in particular who is extremely absent-minded, especially in family worship. So it's time to read the Bible or the Bible story. And she is, you know, not with it. So how do I teach this girl to listen? She must learn to listen. And it's frustrating. But I've been trying to stop after the paragraph, you know, and say, now, Kayla, who are we talking about? What's the man's name? And maybe we're talking about Elijah. And she'll say, Goliath. You know, you've been there, right? I mean, and she remembered Goliath from somewhere. But anyway, we're on Elijah right now. And so you stop and you, okay, now here we go again. But to learn to listen for at least a half hour, I don't know. My first grade teacher has half hour classes, 40 minute classes maybe. All right, well, hopefully she'll get it before she goes to first grade. Self-help skills. You know, it's really valuable if you're youngster goes to first grade and knows how to take care of himself in the bathroom and can wait a whole hour before using the bathroom. That problem will always be. My first and second grade teachers come fairly often with that problem. How can I get Johnny to wait a whole hour? Okay, we'll say, yeah, you can go, Johnny. Just pay me 5 or 10 minutes at recess. And it's amazing how soon it's all over. It's fixed. I don't know what age to start that. It's maybe open for discussion, but anyway. And tie his shoes and hang up his coat and pick up the trash around his desk and those kind of things. I really feel for the first grade teacher when I walk in her room in the evening and it's just the floor is atrocious. I'm sure glad I don't have that problem in high school. Somewhere they learn something. So self-help schools, self-help skills. All right, this is one we think about a lot, the ability to play well with others. And the kindergarten program was in place in my community before I came to our school. So I've asked, why did the kindergarten program get started? Why did we start that? Oh, well, one of the things is we want children to learn how to play together before first grade. So that in first grade, they can have some of that established. So that was supposed to be one of the reasons we had for starting our kindergarten program. Although, I think it can be learned at home. I think there's ways to do that. There's plenty of younger siblings in our home anyway. And there's many, many ways to work on that problem. Number 6, strong fine motor skills. And I guess most children naturally pick up their pencil and start going. It's amazing how awkward that is at first, And it's amazing what a skill that is, writing. You do it all the time, don't even think about it. That's quite the skill. All the little muscles that are involved in that. And developing that is important for a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. I had a friend once who was telling me how his 5-year-old can get on the computer and can pull up the internet and email a person and close back out. And that was just pretty amazing to him. Is that an amazing skill? I don't know. But I say that the coloring book and being able to color in the lines and all that is even a more important skill for a 5-year-old than being able to email. And I think that dad would agree with that, but he was telling me that. I say, may the coloring book live long upon the earth in the life of a 5-year-old, and may it never be replaced by a mouse and a computer. But those are the days that we live in. So if he knows how to use his hand to write, it's good. Basic letter and number recognition. And most children pick this up naturally. They want to know their ABCs and they want to know their numbers. They like to count. And maybe a discussion point could be how much should a 5-year-old know all his sounds? The letters is one thing, but my wife taught school for 7 years. And I was intrigued by the way she taught my oldest daughter back when she was that age, her ABCs. I learned my ABCs A, B, C, D, E, F, G, that way. Well, my little girl came along, and we're in the van going down the road, and she's like, A, B, S, D, E, F. And I said, what's that all about? And Carolyn said, I'm teaching her sounds. And that's the way she did the alphabet. And then it went from there. And then she would look at the letter and say, that's a G, instead of a G. That's a G. Okay. I don't know. Anyway, hats off to my wife. That's the way my girl learned her letters and sounds. So then maybe that's a point of discussion. How much do you drive in all the sounds? Our kindergarten curriculum, we field test CLEs, kindergarten curriculum program, and they pretty much get the sounds across by first grade. And I don't know if nationalism has affected us, Mennonite curriculum developers or not, but CLP has a very rigorous first grade program. And so, yeah, I guess that it only follows that you better have some sound skill in the sounds that letters make. Okay, possibly you can add some more. What do I have there? Three more blanks maybe we can fill out. On the back, yeah, you're on the back, okay. One other objective that I have here is evaluate the strengths of both the home and the school in preparing children for first grade. And I'm just going to maybe open it up now. And we can discuss some of these things for the remaining time. What does the home do best? What does the school do best? Or in the life of a five-year-old, should we even have the school involved yet? Maybe that's controversial. Maybe that's, I don't know where we are on that one. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about curriculum. I don't feel like I have a lot of experience with kindergarten curriculum, but maybe we have some knowledge here among us. I don't know. All right. What would you like to discuss? We were to have about 20 minutes of discussion. So, go ahead.
I would submit a suggestion for another practical skill to develop, learning to sing.
Okay. Learning to sing. We have developed a scope and sequence for our school, and my objective, or the objective that we decided on for kindergarten singing, we have there's a list of certain songs that they should be able to recognize, which most of them do. But the other one, the singing skill then, is to be able to sing in unison, which is almost an impossibility, it seems. I don't know why. My little girl can sing by herself just fine. But as soon as she has to match pitch with someone else, gone. And we have some curriculum people working on that one currently. Joe and Fern Ebersole, I think, are working on some of that and some others. Anyway, that's our goal. Did you want to add some more to that?
Well, I think that's something that parents can be working on for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years old, rather than waiting until they get to school. But it's a good preschool goal as well as kindergarten.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen in your experience that the singing family students always sing better, right? I mean, that's just a given. Yes. Yeah, my little two-year-old, he's got to have his songs before he can sleep. Last night at Lonnie's there, I was about to walk out the door, and he yelled, "Sing!" So back up, got to sing first. Okay. What else? I can venture into a few things about home versus school. In Maryland, in 2006, it became a law to have for private schools. They're fairly generous in Maryland for us, but they want private schools to have a kindergarten program of some kind. I don't know if any of your states are like that. I don't think Pennsylvania's like that, is it? I don't know what Ohio is, but in Maryland, but in 2006, you needed to have something. And you could do it at home, or you could do it at school. Either way, you just needed to have something that you were doing to prepare students for first grade. Some of the reasoning that we applied then was we like our kindergarten program for one way, and that is for one reason. Parents use a lot of different methods for preparing students for first grade. Should we undermine that in any way? Should we say, wait a second, we want all the children to be together on the same page when they come to first grade so we can really start making progress? You know, I almost think this could be a fifth principle over here. But do you notice in Deuteronomy that God was talking to a nation? Hear, O Israel, the nation. And it was all about the nation. And yet, where does God start with education? It's in the home. And God never undermined. And God left the home be what it was. And I know that we all have troubled home situations in our communities. We have our share of them. They drain a lot of energy, or they take a lot of energy. But I hope we never get to the place where we overreact because of that and begin to say, we got our program here, and so you bring your children here. And it's a subtle way of undermining the authority of the home. We have been given, as a school, I heard someone say once that responsibility and authority and accountability always come in equal proportions. And I like that. The school has been given a responsibility, and with that responsibility comes an equal amount of authority to do the work, but with that also comes an equal amount of accountability back to the home. And the home and the church and the school must find their place. And so we do have, as one of the points that comes up for why we have a first grade, a kindergarten program is, well, yeah, we want to get the children all on the same page. But I don't know how hard, I don't really know how hard to push that. I don't know. Any thoughts about that? How far you can go before you really start undermining and the authority of the home, especially thinking about a 5-year-old. It's hard for the teacher because some of the children can read and some of them can't. Okay? What do you think? Yeah. You're right. It does. Okay? Do you stop that? Say, no, shut the book. Put it away. Please don't. Please don't. We have a family of very gifted children in our school, and the dad knows that. He had a gifted mind, and he's told me already. He said, "I do almost nothing to start my children. Because he knows that, they just gravitate toward that. And so I don't push it. I'm not going to push it. They're going to wait till first grade, and if they learn on their own a little bit, he's fine with that. But he doesn't push it. I think that's really kind of where it is." How much are we just pushing that thing?
I think that with that, parents should then be willing to allow their child to be taught the rudiments of reading. Because just because they know how to read, they may not know why the word is the way it is. So say, well, you already know how to read. You have to worry with that. I think parents then need to realize that they need to learn how to read properly.
Yeah, that's a good point in connection with, because little children aren't going to understand everything about phonics. If they are learning to read, it's sight and memorization of the symbols from an older sibling. Yeah, reading is all about symbols, really. But then we have the phonics part of it. Yeah, that's a good point.
Seems like parents like that convenience. Any thoughts on how can the school with profit maybe help parents or guide parents? They're still free to use. Any addition to that or any thoughts on that?
Okay. I'll just add to that kind of what I started out with, that you're actually wise in providing some direction there, I think. And it's the ultimate balance that we're looking for, that on one hand, yes, we want to provide direction. Because something, yeah, parents want to know. They really do, many times. And then we have answers for them. Anyone want to add something to that? Go ahead. Yeah.
It's a fine balance between their, the one son would like to be on the tractor all the time, much rather than in the classroom. And to push him constantly is going to give him, he's not going to get more energy for school. If we constantly push him toward the school, but if we give him a bit of breathing space, whatever, it seems to work. But his next younger brother is going to surpass him because
no, it's not. And they had to be brothers. Yep, that's the way they come sometimes. Yeah, that was the way it worked for my brother and I, only in different areas. He's about a foot taller than me, and he's 3 years younger. Yeah, that's a challenge. Someone want to speak into that?
Things that his friend does better than he. There's things that he excels. And for him to be humble about his accomplishments and appreciate that is a valid accomplishment. And we're different. We have different gifts. And children may not naturally understand that. Maybe that could be something that could
It's a good point.
Something to, that relates to this. Children normally, historically, could spontaneously play, turning somersaults, climbing trees, playing ball, bouncing a ball, jumping, running, playing with jacks, developing along the process, coordination, and being supplied with some things like coloring books and Courage to Color. And is there today, for whatever reason, with all the specific things we have, toys that are more focused on one thing, like a truck, for example, or like you probably heard the that kind of children sometimes have more fun playing with the package than they do the toy that's in it. Now, I wonder if you've seen, I'm talking to this group here, it does seem that some children at least today are unable to play spontaneously. To go play. Sometimes they need to be told what to do. What should we do? A reward. And if children need to be told how to play, it seems to me it's a symptom of something that's very unnatural. Children, puppies play, kittens play, and children play. And I'm not saying they're puppies and kittens, but they're still. And so I think part of parenting in general in the world is not obviously not what it should be. And sometimes they try to toys for the play, what they wanted to occupy themselves. And then when we see that they're not learning the skills they learn that they need, then we intentionally try to teach them so we're sure they learn how to do gross motor skills and fine motor skills and so on. And there's those things need to be learned. But there's a healthy balance somehow between having children be able to spontaneously play, either alone or together, and then also stepping in and encouraging them to do things that they might not do. For example, if they never played pitch and catch, but they all played pitch and catch. So I'm just wondering whether anybody else has anything to say about that. Have you ever observed that children don't know how to play?
Just recent.
My daughter's son from Russia, from an orphanage, at 2 years of age, and he knew very little about playing. He didn't know about sitting on your lap, and we're still teaching him how to play. But he's learning. He's catching the wind. He's fine. He'll be fine. He's four.
Yeah, I recently heard a quote that goes something like this. The amount of troubles you have with your children is in direct proportion to the amount of toys they have. And I have found that to be true.
Just look around your congregation on a Sunday morning in church, and you'll find that principle is true. The more toys you have, the more trouble you have with your children in church. They can be taught.
It's that simple. No, I'm thinking about all of the struggle that goes into that teaching, though, but it's definitely a good point. Okay, anything more in line with what brought up here?
Mm-hmm. And we spent years trying to build that in him.
Yeah, there's some very needy children out there.
We've got a son that's like that. He doesn't like, you can't give him a truck. He doesn't care about a truck or cars or whatever. And but one thing that I've found is that it takes a little more work on my part. There's certain things that he does enjoy. Give him a ball and a bat and somebody throw it to him, he's happy all day long. Give him a football, he'd be glad to run over you. You know, mm-hmm. It's just his skills are different. His personality is different from the rest. And in some ways, to tell a child to go play is an easy cop-out for me. It don't work. Those times when I have to get out and go pitch him a ball or throw him a football or something, you know, those are the times that you know, are really meaningful to him then.
So you would say he's far more interactive. He likes to be
much more
He likes to be interacting with people.
You can't just give him a box matchbox cars and tell him
Yeah, so far all three of mine that are of playing age are very much the kind they want you there doing something with them. Yeah. But Jonas, you seem to be suggesting that we're losing the skill of play. Ability to go out and keep yourself busy or keep yourself occupied. Okay. And even for... Is it because they're just they're bored with the things we do at school. They'd rather be home in front of their computer. I don't know. What is this? Talk. Say. What do you think?
That's what I was going to say, too. Even in school, I mean, I have one in first grade that I also teach. And you can soon tell which students have computer games at home. I'm sorry, parents. I have no time for computer games.
It's endemic.
Yeah, and I think that's in relation to Jonas's that question. I think that's probably one of the largest downfalls to our children's creativity.
It's supposed to enhance creativity. Isn't that the ironic thing? I was raised on Legos and Play-Doh. I don't know. Am I scarred? I don't know. No one ever told me I was. But. Yeah.
I wish that's the message we can get across to the parents.
Yeah. I agree.
And that's one of the reasons why reading to your students, to your children, preschoolers, is such an important thing, because if you're watching a video, everything is all external stimulation. Your mind can go into neutral and your senses take it all in. When you read a book, you have to envision, okay, what did this scene look like? What did the man's voice sound like? All of that. You have to come up with that yourself.
It's a very good point. Yeah, our children have a lot handed to them. I mean, hopefully ours don't, but many are. Okay. Did you have some more you wanted to add to that, of some symptoms?
It's really a responsibility of the church and school to make sure parents hear.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in those years before they ever come to school is critical to everything they get. It's foundational.
Yeah.
And so someone needs to be telling the parents, like your brother here said, that this external input, especially if it's a video or something coming off the screen, is actually, it's a different brainwave activity entirely. You shut down your internal
and traveling. I've talked to many people that they can finally travel now. They just put on the little video and travel away. And that's the way you get somewhere. Hassle free. It's a shame. Well, any closing remarks anyone wants to give? Thank you very much for your discussion, points you brought up. I know I couldn't come up with everything, so I appreciate what you've given. And if there's nothing else, enjoy your day. Consider yourself dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.